Motion versus Albert Villa Cardenas, if I said that correctly.
Good morning. Could I please reserve 2 minutes?
You may.
May it please the court, I'm Kevin March, appearing on behalf of Alberto Avila Cardenas. I intend to focus on the Bruton issue and the ineffective assistance of counsel claim regarding the opening statements, subject, of course, to this court's questions. The admission of Mr. Feliz Fombona's statement on plea of guilty violated Mr. Avila's right to confront a witness against him. The question is whether the guilty plea statement, which stated, "I helped two men kidnap, and I was aware of the other two men were armed with guns, and then that the victims were then killed by the men," whether that facially implicated Mr. Avila. And it did, under the Washington Supreme Court's decision, State v. Fisher, issued last year. As in Fisher, before hearing the statement of Mr. Veles Fombona, the jury had heard evidence that three men exactly were suspected for the murders and knew that these men, according to the state and according to the evidence the state had presented thus far in trial, were Mr. Avila, Mr. Veles, and Mr. Benitez. So because the state referred to this in the opening statement, it was clear that the other two men referred to in the guilty plea statement, one was Avila, and that would be so even if the confession were the first thing admitted at trial. Also, this court has stated that when the precise number of suspects is provided in a guilty plea statement or a co-defendant's confession, that facially implicates. This court stated as much in Van Noy. We're relying on the 11th Circuit case in U.S. v. Gonzalez and in State v. Vincent.
So let's if we assume that the statement was improperly admitted, why wouldn't it have been harmless in this case?
Because it destroyed Mr. Avila's primary defense, which was other suspects. Everybody agreed, the trial court, the state, defense said, yes, go ahead, you have a green light to pursue this other suspect's defense. What happened when this statement was read to the jury is that it destroyed the availability of that defense for Mr. Avila. We analogize, Your Honor, to State v. Jones. In that case, where consent was a defense to rape, the trial court erred by not permitting evidence of the fact that, or the defense theory that the victim and the defendant were engaged in an all-night sex party, and said, you know, that needed to come in so that the defense had an opportunity to present its theory. The same reasoning applies here. Mr. Avila did not have an opportunity to present his theory. Also, the state got in the whole statement of the co-defendant, which provided details, according to the co-defendant, of how this crime occurred. The state wouldn't have been able to introduce any of that had it not been for this Bruton error. And also, I wanted to address quickly the state's theory that Mr. Avila somehow opened the door to this. Again, everybody agreed that this other suspect's theory was available to Mr. Avila. All the defense counsel did is ask, did you suspected Mr. Benitez in this crime, detective, correct? Yes. You suspected Mr. Veles Fombona? Yes. And he pled guilty, didn't he? Yes. That was the only testimony. That didn't open the door. That just laid the foundation to the defense's other suspect theory. And Judge Spearman, you recently wrote State v. Wofford, and you defined opening the door as, quote, introducing evidence that must be rebutted in order to preserve fairness and determine the truth. In Wofford, the issue was a child hearsay statement, which the trial court excluded. When defense counsel misrepresented the contents of that statement, then it was admitted. Because defense had misrepresented or misled the trier of fact. Here, there was no misleading the trier of fact. Mr. Veles Fombona had pled guilty, and defense was just, it was entirely consistent with the state's theory that he had done so. So there was no opening the door, and this Bruton error requires reversal. Now, I wanted to...
Is there any support for the idea that evidence which... arguably violates the confrontation clause can be admitted through the open the door
Not in Washington. I have found no case in Washington. However, we cited several out-of-state cases in this context in the brief, which the state has not responded at all to. The leading one is People v. Reed, a New York Court of Appeals case. There, Reed's co-defendant confessed to being involved in a robbery and a shooting, and the co-defendant said a third man, McFarland, was also involved. And what the defense did with that is said, oh, well, challenged the police testimony and saying, why didn't you investigate McFarland? You knew that this McFarland was involved. Why didn't you investigate him? And under based on defense's angle with the case, the court said that defense had opened the door to the co-defendant's statement that McFarland had no involvement in the crime. So that would be an example of what it takes to open the door in a in the confrontation context. We certainly didn't have that here. If I may, with my remaining time, turn to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Mr. Avila's attorney promised he would present two pieces of exculpatory evidence during opening statement. He presented neither. This destroyed defense counsel's credibility during the trial and rendered the entire trial unfair. The Washington Supreme Court in Greif recognized that unfulfilled promises made by defense during the opening statement are, quote, quite serious. Defense counsel first...
Well, are you arguing they're per se ineffective? I mean, the court said quite serious. Does that mean, that doesn't mean per se ineffective?
No, our argument isn't that they are per se ineffective, but based on the facts here, Your Honor, it was ineffective. Mr. Avila's attorney had no, well, there's two pieces of exculpatory evidence that defense promised. The first was Mr. Avila's adamant denial of any involvement in the crime. Mr. Avila's attorney had no route to admit these statements.
He had the statement already been admitted?
Well, it had been admitted for the purposes of Criminal Rule 3.5, Your Honor, but it hadn't been admitted, and it hadn't been vetted in terms of hearsay or the rule of completeness. And the state used, obviously, the state used the portions of that statement to its advantage, only using the incriminating portions to Mr. Avila about his cell phone records, his denial, or about his denial of having the cell phone or a gun. However, defense counsel thought that the admission of the statement for 3.5 purposes meant that he could introduce any other portion of that statement. He couldn't. It's barred by hearsay.
He was relying on the state to introduce it, was he not?
Well, he seemed to be, and that's not a reasonable strategy, Your Honor. The second is even more alarming, which... when defense counsel promised an exculpatory witness who would conflict with the entire timeline of the state's evidence, and then when he never presented that witness, did nothing to remedy that problem.
Yep,
thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Dennis McCurdy for the state of Washington, respondent in this case. I am asking this court to find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in finding the defendant opened the door to Fambona's statement from his plea of guilty. And even if it was error, it is not an error of under the Confrontation Clause. And by the way, I would indicate it's not a Bruton problem because Bruton didn't exist in this case. Bruton applies when you have a co-defendant in trial and you admit one of the co-defendant statements against that co-defendant and then try and have a limiting instruction for that confession. That's not what existed here. So it's not a Bruton issue. It's a potential confrontation clause issue. But let me read quickly.
Is it also harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, thinking about it more last night, that's really the only question of whether it's a confrontation clause issue or not of what the harmless error standard would be if the court were to find the trial court abused its discretion in finding the door had been open. If it's a confrontation clause and it was improperly admitted, then it's the burden's on the state. If it's not, then it's on the defense. So that's really the only purpose of characterizing whether it's a confrontation clause violation or not. But first, you have to find the trial court inappropriately let this statement in.
And do you have authority that evidence that was in violation of the Confrontation Clause can be admitted under the open the door theory?
Well, in Washington, there is no limitation upon that.
And the authority for that is?
There isn't a single case that limits it. There's no case that says that. I'm not saying I have found a specific case that says, oh, this comes in this situation. There is no limitation that's ever been recognized in the state of Washington of any type.
So are there cases similar to this one where there's confrontation evidence, the court has found that it's opened the door, or are you just saying there's not authority, you're just assuming that's the case?
No, what I'm saying is there's no case in the state of Washington that has placed any limitation, and the defense would concede that as well. They have found none. So they're asking...
You're flipping my question.
I'm
asking you if there's authority that says this kind of evidence can come in on that theory.
In other words, are there other cases where there's been a confrontation clause issue and the court allowed that, or the appellate court said, well, you opened the door, therefore that comes in?
I'm unaware of any case that has specifically addressed that issue where the defense has been, the challenge has been, this violates the Confrontation Clause. What I'm saying is...
That's surprising that it hasn't come up.
What I'm saying is, well, there has never been a limitation placed on the open door.
No, you've said that three times.
I know.
We've got that.
Okay. Let me go
but
back. Let me go back then to the open door doctrine, because the other suspect rule says that the defendant must lay a foundation that establishes a train of fact and circumstances that tends to clearly point to someone besides the defendant committed the crime. That goes all the way back to Downs in 168 Washington 667. Now you have the open door rule, where a defendant cannot explore broad areas and seek to leave inferences with the jury and then preclude the state from attempting to explain or rebut the inferences. Now, the critical thing here is Frambona and Benitez were not other suspects. They were additional suspects. And defense counsel knew that. Defense counsel knew that his statement in his plea of guilty indicated that there were other people involved. Now, that statement names nobody. It identifies nobody. It's simply a question of, was there other people involved? And the defense says, well, there's only three people. We don't know how many people were involved in this as well. But
there's no evidence there's more than three.
Not that it was presented, that's true.
So that's all we know is there's three.
That's all we know, that's correct. But that doesn't mean there wasn't others, because...
Well, if there's some evidence in the record, we'll assume there's others. Otherwise, we'll go with what's there.
But the defense also says, and I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to the Confrontation Clause argument, the defense says that this statement implicated the defendant. But the critical question that this court should be asking is, who was Frambona referring to in his statement? Now, in all of the cases that we're using by analogy, the Bruton cases, the statement either names the person, and it's redacted, and the redaction is something is replaced, redacting the person that we know who it is. In this case, there is no redaction. It was read word for word what Frambona had in his plea statement. We don't know who he was referring to. Not in the statement, because it's not listed. There's not a redaction. He doesn't refer to him by name. He doesn't refer to him by where they live. He doesn't refer to him by anything that from that statement you can infer this is who it is. What the defense wants to do is then take the evidence at trial and say, oh, he must be referring to him. What, how can you say he's referring to him when we don't even know from the statement to begin with who he's referring to? And I would indicate what his argument was, what was rejected in Richardson v. Marsh. It's essentially the contextual implication doctrine is what the Supreme Court did or said was rejected, because in that case there was no reference at all to the defendant or any other person, and the defendant still argued that the statement implicated him. And the lower court in that case found that that was in fact correct. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You don't look at the evidence that's presented at trial and then decide whether the statement referenced somebody. It has to be something that is inferred from the statement itself, something in the statement itself. And that doesn't...
What would you think the jury is going to infer from that statement?
Well, that there was two other people involved. But are they going to infer specifically...
There's sufficient for the jury... There's a basis for the jury to infer that it's Mr. Avila Cardenas?
Sure. But that's the case in every case, isn't it? Every single case where you're admitting a statement like this, because what the defense wants to say is, here's the person sitting at trial. Therefore, they can infer it's him. But that's not what the Supreme Court said. And I think what's really good from that case is the Supreme Court gave an example. Actually, it was in the following case, Gray v. Maryland. The Supreme Court said the question that was asked in that case was, who was in the group that beat Stacy? That was an assault, a beating death. The answer was, that was read to the jury, was, me, delete, delete, and a few other guys. And they said, well, the only reason you would delete that and have that read to the jury, clearly they make an inference it's the two people sitting at trial. But the Supreme Court went on and said, what the witness could have said, the question could have been, who was in the group that beat Stacy? Answer, me and a few other guys. Now, you can draw the same inference that the person sitting in trial, because that's who the state is accused, are the people he's referring to, but the point is it doesn't come from the statement itself, and even the inference.
Can you address real quick the closing, the argument about prosecutorial misconduct on the closing argument, the argument that the defendant believed he could get away with this because they were Mexican?
I will, Your Honor. First of all, in starting with that, I made an argument that it wasn't preserved, the failure to object, which actually... I shouldn't say it doesn't preserve, it changes the standard. Now, the defense said, well, we made an objection, but it was overruled, and that was sufficient. But I think it's critical to look at what he's claiming the prejudice is. He's claiming that the state portrayed the defendant out to be a racist and a classist. Well, what's interesting is there had no mention of any race or class or anything about the victims. Prior to when he made that first objection that said we were pandering to the prejudice of the jury. So how can that objection lead to stuff that happened after that that was really on a different subject? So I do.
But is there any evidence in the record to support the argument that was made?
Well, what did the defendant do? The defendant went, kidnapped three people, took them out into a wooded area, and executed them. And then left their bodies.
And he thought he would get away with it.
Then he went right back to his normal life.
Right.
That's what he did.
What does that have to do with being Mexican?
And these, well, the fact that they were Mexican, I think one is they're not, none of them, all three of them, they weren't American citizens. They might be. I don't know if they were here legally or not legally. I don't think that ever came out in the testimony. They were all essentially temporary workers. One of them, I think, had only been working at this place, I think, for a month or two, as I recall, but had worked there like 5 years ago, kind of disappeared and came on back. I think the idea was that maybe there wasn't going to be that much of a concern. It wasn't going to be in the news. Now, whether that's an appropriate argument or not as well, maybe I wouldn't have made that argument. But then you also still have to prove prejudice. And I don't know how you can prove that here. Can I finish that one thought? Just one. Because the idea about racism, the defendant himself is Hispanic. Everybody in the case is Hispanic. I don't make the connection where the defendant says the state was painting the defendant out to be a racist. It simply doesn't follow. It might not be a good argument, but it doesn't follow from that argument.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The state seems to be claiming that the other suspect's theory wasn't available to the defense, yet the state is the one that conceded that Mr. Avila was entitled to present an other suspect's defense, so that argument should not be accepted by this court. Also, the state really doesn't address what our Supreme Court...
I think they're arguing that because it really wasn't an other suspect's issue, that they're... to the extent there was an error, was harmless. I think that's the point.
Well, that's not how I understood their argument, Your Honor. But everybody agreed that they could that Mr. Avila could present an other suspect's defense, and by eliciting information that Mr. Velez-Fombona pled guilty, defense was simply laying a foundation consistent with that other suspect's defense, and it was extremely prejudicial to eliminate that avenue of defense for Mr. Avila. The state also isn't addressing the Fisher case, and I know that the state's relying on Richardson v. Marsh, but that case was cabined by Gray and said, well, you know, there are what matters is the type of inference that the jury can draw. Here, the state's whole theory were these three men and these three men exactly together committed these murders. The only inference of it that the jury could have possibly drawn here was that Mr. Avila was one of the two men that Mr. Velez-Fombona's guilty plea statement referred to. As for prosecutorial misconduct, the state argued, it's akin to the send a message cases. It's the state said that he committed these murders because he thought that nobody would care about Mexicans who worked in warehouses, and thus made Mr. Avila the scapegoat, the whipping boy for racist attitudes, classist attitudes, and the failures to address those in our criminal justice system. So based on that, we'd ask that this court reverse and give Mr. Avila a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you.